Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Pei Vav Amud Aleph by the two dots. Kufa, we're discussing something that we had mentioned at the end of yesterday's daf. Amar Shmuel, a mocher shtar chov lechaveiro, someone who sells a debt document to his friend. He has an outstanding loan to a debtor, and this creditor then sells the right of collection to another party. V'chazar omechalo. And then the originator of the loan goes ahead and forgives the loan after he sold it to a third party. Machul, it works. And the debt is forgiven. Vafilu yoresh mochel. And even if a party inherits the right of collection, inherits the outstanding loan, they have the right to forgive the loan, even though the right of collection has been sold to a third party. So, for instance, in situations where one has extended a loan to a debtor, or a company has outstanding receivables, which they factor and sell to another party, in each of those instances, the originator of the loan or the one whose receivables it was originally can forgive the loan after they've sold the right of collection to another party. Not only can they do that, if someone inherits them who would otherwise be the creditor in this case, if the loan had not been sold, they also have the right of mechila. So, Amar Avuna Brei de Rav Yeshua, v'pikeachu, if the buyer is smart, mekarkish leizuze, he will shake some money in front of the debtor, v'katav leishtara b'shmei, and then he'll have him write over a new document, a new borrowing document in his name. So if the individual purchased these receivables or purchased the right of collection to the outstanding loan, then those individuals, instead of relying on the original loan document, and there are reasons to rely on the original loan document because it will benefit them from the perspective that the lien and the ability to extract the money from lekuchot, from purchasers of the property, will be based on the date of the original loan, but not from the day that it was sold to him. On the other hand here, if they write a new loan document that testifies to the fact that the purchaser of the loan now has the right of collection, then the new date on that document will actually make it a later date from which he has the right of collection that his lien starts. Now, it might be worth it anyway, because that will prevent the ability of the seller of the loan from forgiving it and then ruining the entire transaction for him. So in order to protect himself, he should offer the debtor some sort of discount or encouragement to rewrite the document where the outstanding loan will be to him and not to the original party. Again, the loss in that, as the Ritva says, is that he will have to date it from the later date, rather than the earlier date, and his lien, therefore, would be compromised because he would have a later date on the new document. There are those, Rishonim, that want to suggest that when they rewrite the document, they rewrite it from the date of the origination of the loan, and therefore there would be no loss from him doing this. And the advantage would be that he wouldn't have to go to court in order to collect from the one who forgave the loan, which we're going to see in a second, whether he's culpable for causing that loss, or to collect the monies that he expended over here to pay the debtor in order to ensure that his loan is intact. And now, Amemar explains to us what happens to this individual who actually forgave the loan. He was the originator of the loan, and now he's selling off that debt to someone else, and then goes ahead and forgives that debt. He's caused a loss to that party. So what happens in that instance? What type of recourse does the buyer have? So, man de dain dini de garmi, the one who adjudicates cases where it's not direct damage, but some form of indirect damage. This is a sugya in the Gemara in Baba Kama, which we won't get into too deeply here. But garmi is something that sits between grama, which is indirect causation of loss, and hezek, which is a directed damage of an individual. Garmi is still something that is indirect, but it's very clear that your action has a direct impact on the other individual. And that's in the case here. This person, by forgiving the loan, will definitely cause a loss to the party that purchased the right of collection from him. So those that believe, like Rabbi Meir, that you are dying dini de gamay, then megabe be dmei shtarim alio, then he'll be able to collect the full amount of the shtar. Man de lo dying dini de gamay, the one who does not allow for the adjudication or to make someone responsible for paying for such type of damage, megabe be dmei niyaro ba'almo, then he gets to collect the value of the underlying paper. So now let's discuss what this means. There is a machloket as to what, first of all, demei shtora means. The ability to collect the value of the shtar. There are two possible ways to explain the demei shtar. One is that he gets the full amount of what he would have collected. So if he had actually exercised his right to collect over here, and that's what he purchased, he would have collected this amount. That is what he gets to now extract from the party who sold him the loan, because his forgiveness caused that type of loss to him. And therefore, he can go to him and ask him for the payment for that loss that he caused him. On the other hand, there are those that believe that he just gets a refund for the money that he paid. He paid for the right of collection. He didn't pay the full value of the loan in order to collect it. He paid some sort of discounted price in order to take that and be a collection agent. Similar to when someone buys bad debt or debt off another party, they pay 95 cents, 90 cents, 70 cents on the dollar in order to be granted the right to go and collect that money. So the Demei Shtoro, according to many of the Gaonim, refers to that money that he paid up front when he gets that refunded, but not that he gets the full value of the contract or debt that he would have otherwise collected. Whereas the Rabbeinu Hananel and the Ramban and many of the other Rishonim believe that you actually get the full amount that was in the shtar, the full outstanding debt. Again, whatever he had the right to collect and that he could have collected, that is what the one who forgives the loan will have to reimburse him for, because that's the loss that he caused him. On the other hand, if we are not dying dini digarmi, all he gets is the value of the paper. Now, some suggest that he gets nothing. The value of the paper is just as an expression that's used in other contexts. And here it just means that he gets to keep the paper that it was written on, but nothing more than that. He has no recourse against the person who forgave him. On the other hand, there are some that explain, since now when the loveh repays the loan or is forgiven in the loan, the debt document has to be returned to the loveh. So this purchaser who got that document now is going to have to return the paper to this individual, and the originator of the loan will have to reimburse him for the loss of that paper. So there's a real value here. There is one view in the Rishonim that he would have to reimburse him for the amount that he paid, and that the full amount of the shtar means the full amount of the debt. And in this case, the paper means the amount that he used to purchase this debt from the other party. Well, that seems far-fetched, because then there wouldn't be much difference between the two positions. Haba'uvda, there was an instance. Vikafye Rafram, the Ravashi, and Rafram pressed Ravashi, v'agvebe, and he collected it. Kishura the Talmei, like a board to a designer of images or a person who draws images. So now, as Rashi explains over here, there was a case in which Rav Ashi was adjudicating the case, and Rafram, through his proofs or through his erudition, was able to compel Rav Ashi to collect in this case, similar to a Kshura Letzalmei, just like when a person takes a board and buys a board in order to draw on it or to make images on it. They make sure that the board is very flat and perfect. They take a lot of effort to distinguish or determine which board to buy. Similarly, over here, he was very medaktik about the loss that was caused to this party through the forgiveness of the loan, and therefore he compelled him to have the party that did that repay the individual that who he had sold the loan to. On the other hand, the Ritva said that the meaning over here is that he collected from him in the best way possible, which is that there's a difference between collections of loans, which comes out of Benonit, middle-range property, and collections of hezek, damage, which comes out of idit, the best quality property. And therefore, Rafram compelled Rav Ashi to collect from idit because he deemed what happened here to be nezek, not a regular repayment of a loan. And as the Ritva says, similar to someone who purchases a board that has images drawn on it, you don't just pay for the board, you pay for the images as well. And so over here is too, you're not just going to repay the loan, you're going to repay it as if you've done damage, and therefore you have to give from the best property that is possible. And so Rafram over here, where Rav Ashi was somewhat uncertain as to how to adjudicate in this case, whether to deem it as dine degarmi, or to deem it as a davar hagorim lemamon, Rafram compelled him to view it as being dine degarmi and full nezek, and therefore he should collect in a full manner. Now, after we've seen all of this, we actually have to go back now and discuss the last case that we saw in the Gemara, which was the case of the woman who had sold her ketubah, then passed away, and then her daughter inherited that right. And after inheriting that right, she was told by Rav Nachman to forgive the loan. And we asked back then, what was the advantage of her forgiving the loan? Because in the end, the beneficiary would be her father, who was the one who had to pay out the ketubah. So yesterday we discussed some of the options, and here Tosafot, in discussing those options, raises the issue that based on the conclusion of the Gemara here, that we're dying dini degarmi, that in this case we're going to hold the person who forgives the loan accountable for that, then what was the advantage of her forgiving the loan, according to Rav Nachman, she would still be on the hook and responsible to compensate for that loss that she caused by forgiving the loan. Now, according to those that believe that when we pay out the shtar here, it means that the discount and rate at which the purchaser bought the debt in order to collect it, then there is a difference. The full amount of the ketubah is what was owed to these individuals who purchased the ketubah from their mother. But if we say that all we give them is the price that they paid for that right of collection, that amount was significantly lower. As we said yesterday, they paid the present value of the option for the possibility that they could collect the ketubah if the husband predeceases the woman or if she gets divorced. But that isn't the full value of the ketubah. So there is a differential, meaning the savings between the amount that they paid for it originally and the full amount of the ketubah, and therefore the forgiveness of the ketubah has some value. Tosafot also introduces the possibility that maybe she was a ketana, and since she was a ketana, she would not be held accountable for her actions in dine degarmi. So even though she did cause a loss, they wouldn't have recourse against her because she was a ketana. Whereas others suggest that she was married, and therefore you couldn't get any claim against her because as a married woman, her husband has veto rights from any of that money leaving her if she does forgive the loan. Or others still suggest that she was penniless. She had no money, so there was nothing to collect from in this instance. And the Ramban actually offers a possibility that maybe Rav Nachman's idea was that she would go out to forgive the loan, and when they knew about that, the people who wanted to collect the ketubah would try to negotiate with her, and therefore she would end up in a better position because they would either compensate her or take a discount in order to ensure that she did not forgive the loan in this instance. Okay, now we continue in the Gemara with another statement from a Meimar. I'm a Meimar Mishmei de Rav Chama. Hai mandika leik ketubat isha ubal chov. An individual who is a debtor owes money both to a bal chov, to a creditor, as well as to his wife in payment of her ketubah. Vitle ara, vitle zuze. And in order to repay this, he has cash, and he also has land. He doesn't have sufficient of either to pay both parties, but he has enough of each item to pay one of the parties. The bal chov mislavgin le bezuze. We pay off the bal chov, the creditor, with cash. Lisha mislavgin la be'ara. On the other hand, the woman, we pay her off with the land, because in terms of the loan that was granted to this individual by the creditor, he put out cash to him. So in that case, we'll give preference or preferential treatment to the bal chov, to the creditor, in repaying him with cash, because that's what he actually laid out in order to grant this person the loan. On the other hand, when it comes to ketubat isha, that woman never put anything up. She has a right of collection, and truthfully, her lien is on the land and not on the metalklim, not on the cash. And therefore, we'll grant her the land. The advantage, obviously, of getting the cash is that it's ready and available and you can use it immediately. On the other hand, the getting of land, you have to monetize the land in order to use that money. So therefore, we will grant the right to the bal chov first to get the cash, and then to the ketubat isha, we collect it out of the land. Hai kidinei, v'hai kidinei. Each one of them according to their din, which as we just explained before, that the creditor extended a cash loan to the individual. So he pays him in cash. The woman was granted the ketubah with a lien on the land, and therefore we'll pay her in land. If there isn't sufficient funds in the estate or for this individual to repay both parties over here, and there's only enough for one. So he only has land, and the land is only sufficient to repay one of the two here. We give it to the creditor, and we do not give it to the woman with the ketubah. As Rashi points out here, this assumes that they both have a claim or their documents are dated on the same date. So nobody has precedence in terms of the lien because their lien began on the same day. On the other hand, if the ketubat isha had preceded the creditor, then according to Rashi, there's no question that the ketubat isha would get precedence because she has the first right of collection. She has the first lien and she would be paid out first. So the question only arises when they have the same rights. When they have the same rights, we'll give preferential treatment to the bal chov over the isha. My time, what's the reasoning behind this? Because more than the man wants to get married, the woman wants to get married. And therefore, this will not be a factor in women deciding to get married. They understand this risk, but for their desire to get married, this will not be something that stops them from getting married. Now, Tosafot raises a serious issue over here because we saw before that we many times give precedence to the ketubat ha'isha mishum chinah. because of the chayin that we do want to encourage, whether according to Rashi, the men will find favor in the eyes of the women, or according to the Tosafot or Ben Hananel, that the women will find favor in the eyes of the men. But this idea of chayin gives the Ketubat Isha some sort of precedence. All of a sudden over here, we subvert that to this idea that the woman wants to get married. And since she wants to get married, we don't worry about the fact that she may not be able to collect her ketubah. So, v'teiretz Rabbeinu Tam. So, Rabbeinu Tam suggests over here, the hochi avin on the bachov, mishum di'ika taima denila delet. Over here, we also have a competing reason that has to do with the loan market. If we give precedence to the ketubat isha over here over the collection of the creditor, we actually will cause problems for liquidity in the loan market. If lenders believe that they're not going to get repaid when there's a ketubat isha there and they do not take precedence, then they might hold back from lending out, and we will have a liquidity issue in the market. So in order to facilitate liquidity in the market, they gave precedence to the Baal Chov. So in those competing interests between Nila Delet Bifnei Lavin, that it will close out the market to borrowers versus the issue of Chayin, we gave precedence to Nila Delet Bifnei Lavin. On the other hand, in the case that we discussed earlier, over there, there was no problem of Nila Delet Bifnei Lavin because the person passed away, and mita lo shchicha, death is not a common occurrence, and therefore the creditor does not think of instances in which the individual passed away, and then the ketubat isha will get precedence. That's not what he's worried about. He's worried about normal course. In a normal course situation, there he wants to know that he is the first one to get repaid in order to maintain liquidity in the market. Whereas the Ri disagrees with Rabbeinu Tam and says that even after mita, even after death, we still would give precedence to the Baal Chov over the Ketubat Isha. And then why is it that in the previous Gemara we talked about the Ketubat Isha because of Chayin, and over here we do not invoke that principle? That is because in that case, if the individual who was the Shomer and had the Pikadon by him was to give up the object, it would go back to the Yitomim. So in a sense, the Baal Chov has no rights to that object, because if the Nifgad gives up the object, it will automatically go back to the Yorshim. And since now when the Nifgad, we're to face that object from the Nifgad, we're saving it from going back to the Yorshim, at that point we can make a decision about whom to distribute it to. And over there we'll give precedence to the Ketubat Isha. Because over there the Baal Chov really doesn't have a claim. In essence, it belongs to the Yorshim. It's only because it's sitting with this Nifgad, the Pikadon is there, that he doesn't have a right of collection on it. And technically he has no right to it whatsoever. So in that case, since he has no right to it anyway, we'll give precedence to the Ketubat Isha Mishum Chayin. But over here in the case where the Baal Chov has a real claim over here, and he has rights to the property and equal rights to the Ketubat Isha, will give precedence to the Baal Chov in order to protect the liquidity of the market and subvert the Ketubat Isha, because Yoter Mima Sheish Rotzeh Leisa, Isha Rotzeh Lehinasei. And then Tosavot adds in his biggest chiddush, which is Afilu Kadim Zman HaKetubah LeZman HaShtar. Even if the ketubah is dated prior to the shtar, in a case where she is collecting from metaltalim based on the takanata geonim, that today we collect even from metaltalim, not just from karaka. So in that instance, kevin shalom tikno shetitrof min alukuchot, since they never made a takanah that she's allowed to go after the buyers, lo chal shibud ketubah alayu klal, the shibud never goes on them at all. Vavilu kililu zman shaveh, and it's as if they are equal, their time periods are equal. Because since there was no lien on the metaltalim, the date on the shtar makes no difference as to who we give precedence to. And therefore, the Isha and the Baal Chov will have the same rights, despite the fact that the ketubah is dated earlier than the loan document, because shibud is not relevant with regards to metaltalim, and therefore we will favor the Baal Chov in that instance to give him the metaltalim and not the Isha. Is it really true what I hear that you say over in the name of Rava? Haman demaski bezuze, person who is indebted, he owes money, vidle ara, and he has land. Vata bacho v'katova mine, and the creditor comes to make a collection for him, v'amalei, zil shko me ara. He says, look, go take the land. Amrinan le zil zavinat. We say back to the debtor, you sell the land, and then you give him cash. We don't put the creditor out by making him take the land and monetize it. Rather, you, the debtor, monetize the land and pay him. Look, he says, that's not the case. He says, wait a minute, tell me what the whole case was, because that is not normative law, that we would force the debtor to monetize the land rather than the creditor. So please tell me what the case was that you're thinking of, because I don't think that you got the din right over here. So I'm late. So he explains to him the case was, he suggested that his money was locked up with a Oved Kochavim. Who asa shelo kehogen? He acted inappropriately. Lefika hasubo shelo kehogen. Therefore, the Chachamim penalized him by making him sell the land and acted with him, quote unquote, inappropriately. So the way Rashi explains that tole ma'utav b'oved kochavim was that he had cash to repay the loan, but he claimed that that money belonged to someone else or belonged to an oved kochavim, and therefore he could not utilize it to repay the loan. Tosafot refines that and says that when he came to make the claim against him, to ask him for the money, he says, no, that money belongs to Oved Kochavim. And by the time they came to actually make the collection, the money was no longer available because he had utilized it or he had given it to the Oved Kochavim. So he denied him the collection from the cash. And then in the meantime, he used or utilized the cash. So therefore, we penalize him because since he did have the cash at the time and he should have repaid the loan through the cash, the fact that he kept it for himself and then utilized it, we penalize him by forcing him to monetize the land rather than the creditor. So even though if truthfully the money belonged to the non-Jew, he was right in saying that you should take from the land and not the money, we don't believe him that the money belongs to the non-Jew, or he feels that there's some pressure from the Oved Kochavim that's going to force him to utilize this cash. So we don't believe him in that instance, and therefore we force him to be the one to monetize the karka and not the creditor himself. So that's why it says here, Asu Shiloka Hogan. He acted inappropriately. We don't believe him. For the Chachamim acted, quote-unquote, inappropriately with him. It's inappropriate because, technically, if he was telling the truth, we would not force him to monetize the land. But since we don't believe him, therefore we allow, it's actually Kehogan, they did do what was right. Now, if, in the sense, he was lying completely, then it wouldn't be Shlo Kehogan, it would have been Kehogan. Then they should have forced him to sell the land, it wouldn't even be a question. But over here, where it's just a chashash that we don't believe him, that's why it says that the Chachamim acted Shlo Kehogan, because they did not believe his claim, even though if his claim was right, he would have been entitled to pay out of land and not out of money. But because we don't believe him, therefore we acted inappropriately, quote unquote, with him and forced him to monetize the land rather than the creditor. And the Tosafot Reed actually has an alternate girsa which doesn't say in it, Shasulo Shalo Kehogan, that they didn't act appropriately with him. Actually, Kehogan, they did act appropriately with him because he had cash. And he lied about the fact that it belonged to the Oved Kochavim. On the other hand, it says, V'igar sinanle, if you do have a Shlo Kehogan, yesh lomar shotoa Oved Kochavim kafar, v'lakach ma'utav, came along and took all of his money, apisho de, because he had admitted or had said that it was this guy's money. V'mar kihim shel Oved Kochavim, nishach shablo zuzay, now he has no money, similar to what we explained before, that he had the money at the time, but then because of his actions, the money was lost between the time that we came to make the claim against him and the time it came for the actual collection. So just in summary, what we have seen here so far is, first of all, one of the kulot of the ketubah is that when the ketubah comes into conflict with a baal chov, that the baal chov gets precedence in terms of repayment over the ketubah. Number two is, in terms of repayment, the baal chov, the creditor, gets first rights to the cash versus the ketubah, which we would repay in karka. The ability to repay with any cash equivalents or any equivalent item is a riboy in the Torah from Yeshiv that applies by Nizakin, by Hezek. But by the Baal Chov, we're always going to press on the debtor to repay in cash, because, first of all, that is what the creditor lent him. And in addition to that, we want to maintain liquidity in the market. And as the Reed explains over here, if it's metaltalin, we tell the Lovet to go and take the metaltalin, monetize them, and repay the debt to the creditor. On the other hand, with land, where if he had to sell it under pressure, he would have to make a fire sale and take a huge loss. Over there, we could say he can grant the land to the creditor and let the creditor monetize it over time when he's not under pressure so that it maintains its value. So in that case, the Baal Chov would collect out of the land and we would not force the Lovet to monetize it because he would suffer tremendous losses by having to monetize it under duress. And so for that reason, we allow him to give the land to the creditor. But anytime there's cash available, we will always compel the individual to give the cash first to the Baal Chov, and mostly because of Lotin Ol Delebi Bnei Levin, we want to keep liquidity in the loan market, and therefore we want to help the creditors to get back their cash and not be stuck with collateral or land instead of the cash that they lent out. Amalei Rav Kahana, Amalei Rav Papa, L'didach Tamar, according to you, who says, Priyat Baal Chov Mitzvah, the repayment of a loan is a mitzvah, Amar lo nechali di aved mitzvah. If the individual says, you know what, I know that the repayment of a loan is a mitzvah, but I'm not so interested in doing the mitzvah. My, what do we do in that case? What is Beit Din empowered to do? Amar lo tanina, it's a mishnah. Bamed dvarim amurim, when do we just give a person malkot b'mitzvot lo taseh? That's when they're in violation of a lo taseh. There they get malkot for the violation of the lo taseh. Aval b'mitzvot taseh, when it comes to positive commandments, kagon shomrim lo aseh sukkah v'eino aseh, we tell him build a sukkah, do the mitzvah of sukkah, and he doesn't do it. Lulav, take the lulav v'eino aseh. Malkin oto hashetesh tein nafsho. We give him malkot until he gives up, meaning until he dies. We compel him to do the mitzvah taseh. So this is a mitzvah taseh to repay the loan. And if he rejects the doing of this mitzvah, then we will compel him through malkot in order to do the mitzvah. Now the Ramban notes over here that before we go ahead and give him malkot, we're more likely to go down into his property and actually take the property, confiscate the property on behalf of the creditor. Because if we're already going to be kofei oto, we're going to force him or compel him to repay it. Instead of forcing him, let us just confiscate the property and give it to the individual. So when we talk about kofin over here, it doesn't always mean kofin that we physically compel him to do it. We might also just take the land and compel him to do it by confiscating his land. And Tosafot over here qualifies and says that when we say that priyat bachol, the repayment of a loan, is a mitzvah, that's only when there's achoriyut nechassim. That's only in a case where the properties of the debtor are encumbered to pay it. In that instance, there is a mitzvah to repay the loan. And in cases where there's not achoriyut nechassim, there might be a mitzvah to repay the loan, but we will not compel the individual then to repay the loan in that instance. Now Rashi says the source for the fact that priyat bachov is a mitzvah is based on the Gemara in Baba Metzia that says hin tzedek, and the Gemara there darshins that hein shechat tzedek, v'lav shechat tzedek, that you have to stand by your word. And if you gave someone the word that you would repay them, you borrow the money, then you have to stand by that word. And that is what compels an individual or the mitzvah that one has in repayment of a loan. Most of the Rishonim in this sentence believe the source for Priyat Bachov is not what Rashi states over here, but rather the Pasuk in the Torah which says, Yotzi alecha et avot achutza, that he will bring out the collateral to you in lieu of payment of the loan. So there is an obligation on the individual to provide something to repay the loan. Okay, now we continue in the Gemara. Bamine Rami Bar Chama Rav Chista. Rami Bar Chama queried Rav Chista, this is your get, but it will not become effective until 30 days from now. And then she went, and then they went and put it down on the sides of the Rishut Rabim. Mahu, what's the din? So, she is not divorced because of something we learned in Rav and Shmuel earlier. The Rav Shmuel, the Amri Tarvayu, they both said, that is only the case when they are piled up in the Rishut Rabim. This is talking about items that belong to an individual that would automatically be inherited by the Yorshim. They don't automatically go to the Yorshim in these instances because they're not found in a place where the Yorshim can exert ownership or a claim over them. Since they are in the Rishut Rabim, then kola kodem zachaben. Whoever gets there first has the right to them, whether that's the Isha for the Ketubat Isha, if that's the Baal Chov for the outstanding loan. And now the Gemara makes a statement, V'tzidei Rishut HaRabim K'Rishut HaRabim Damu. The sides of the Rishut HaRabim have the same status as the Rishut HaRabim itself. Now, this is interesting from a number of reasons. First of all, what exactly is the scenario over here when he says this is your get and only become effective in 30 days? As Tosafot points out, normally, if that's the case, the get would only be effective 30 days later if it's actually in her hand, or he hands it to her 30 days later. And that is because if the effective date was only 30 days later, and in order to effectuate a get, the husband has to grant the get to the wife and has to be in her possession, then if 30 days later it's not in her possession, she actually would not be divorced. And therefore, based on the case that we have in the Gemara, it would seem like she wouldn't be divorced simply because she doesn't have the get in her possession at the 30-day mark when it's going to go effective. So what Tosafot describes over here and many of the other Rishonim agree to is that he actually said me'achshav. He says that we will effectuate the kinyan today, which is harizeh gitech me'achshav, ve'lo tidgarshi bo alalachar 30 yom, but it only become effective in 30 days. So that means the maaseh of the kinyan was done today and it was effectuated today. On the other hand, the effectiveness of the get will only be in 30 days from now. So now the question of the Gemara is, where is the get at the time point when it becomes effective? And Rami Bar Chama queries Rav Chisda, if the get is found in the city of Shutabim, can it become effective there? And Rav Chisda responds to him and says no, because we see from the din of Rav and Shmuel that one does not have ownership, or that's not a place of exertion of rights of ownership when you are in the Rishut Rabim. And from that he extrapolated to the Tzide Rishut Rabim, and therefore the get does not go effective 30 days later. On the other hand, the Ramban and many of the other Rishonim believe that they did not use the Lashon of Me'achshav over here, and the question of the debt being effective and the Kinyan being effectuated 30 days later, which Tosafot says is a problem because there's no Netina to get and 30 days later, and it's not in her possession. Over here, the Ramban says that's not an issue because the man handed the get to the woman originally. And since he handed to her originally, that creates the Maaseh HaKinyan, which will still be effective 30 days later. Only question is, where is it when it gets to that 30-day period? And since the Rishut Rabim, it does not leave the possession of the man and go to the possession of the woman 30 days later, because the Rishut Rabim is not an area that automatically allows her to gain ownership or control over the get without a Kinyan Hagbah. Therefore, it's not effective, because even though there was a Masev Netina originally, we still need a change of ownership at that 30-day point to both effectuate and make the debt effective according to the Shita of the Ramban. So it fails from both of those perspectives because it's in Tzidei Rishut Rabim, which is deemed to be similar to the Rishut Rabim. Now, this is somewhat problematic as well because earlier in the Gemara, we said with regards to Rav and Shmuel, we were midayek that when it comes to Rishut Rabim, that it was true in Rishut Rabim, it was not true in a Simta, which made it sound like the Simta was different than the Rishut Rabim. And from that, Tosafot actually concludes that there must be three different locations. There must be something called the Simta, there's the Tzidei Rishut Rabim and the Rishut Rabim. With regards to the Rishut Rabim, everybody believes that the Rishut Rabim is a place where you cannot gain ownership without a Kinyan Hagbah. You cannot exert ownership there. Simta, according to Rav and Shmuel, is a location where you can get possession. And that's why the Yorshim were able to take over their father's possession if it was sitting in a Simta. The Tzidei Rishut Rabim are a location that sits somewhere between the Simta and the Rishut Rabim, which is that in the Tzidei Rishut Rabim, Tfisa will work. But on the other hand, even though for other Diminim, like carrying on Shabbat, the Tzidei Rishut Rabim may not be deemed or have the same din as Rishut Rabim. So Tzidei Rishut Rabim will have this in-between status where for certain Kinyanim and for Shabbat, it will be deemed not to be Rishut Rabim. On the other hand, in terms of the ownership or the original ownership of an individual to be exerted over there, that can't happen, and therefore would not automatically go to the Yorshim, and Tfisa would still be effective in that location. So the Gemara says, Adarabba migureshet midrav Nachman. She should be divorced because of the statement of Rav Nachman. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Baravua. Omer lechaveiro mishoch parazu, velo tiyek nuyalecha adachar shloshim yom. You should do a kinyan mishicha on this para, and it will not become effective until after 30 days. Kana, he does acquire it. And even if the para at that time is sitting out in the swamps or in the marshes, at that time it will become effective. My love, hainu agam, hainu tzidei v'shut rabim. From that we want to compare between the agam and the tzidei v'shut rabim to say that they are equivalent. And we see here that the kinyan, which was done earlier, becomes effective 30 days later when he is in a location that's equivalent to the tzidei v'shut rabim. Grant says, lo, agam lachud. But Tzidei Rishut Rabim Lachud, Agam is by itself, and Tzidei Rishut Rabim are Lachud. Tzidei Rishut Rabim are more like the Rishut Rabim. The Agam is more like the Simta that we saw earlier. Now again, over here, the Tosafot will suggest that the Kinyan was effectuated immediately because they used the term Yachshav. And the only question is, when the Kinyan goes effective, where is the Parah at that time? It has to be in a location where the individual could take possession of it. So if it's in the Tzidei Rishut Rabim, we would have assumed that he couldn't take possession of it. And if he could take possession of it, that means that the get should also be effective there. On the other hand, if the agam is different than the Tzidei Rishut Rabim, which is the conclusion of the Gemara, then only in the agam is it effective because there he can take possession of it versus the Tzidei Rishut Rabim, where it would not become effective. On the other hand, the Ramban again would say that both the effectuation and the effectiveness of the Kinyan is happening at a later date at the 30-day point. And the question is it in a location where even though you did the Maaseh HaKinyan earlier, that Maaseh HaKinyan can become effective and be effectuated because it's in a location where transference of ownership is possible, even without a Kinyan Hagba'ah. That will be true in the Agam. It will not be true in the Tzidei Rishut Rabim. Ikedamre, some say, Amalei Migureshet. Some say that Rav Chista answered Rabbi Racham and says that it is a good get. Mid Rav Nachman, and he proved it from Rav Nachman. Tzidei Rishut Rabim, Ka Agam Dami. And there he believed that the Agam and the Tzidei Rishut Rabim are equivalent areas. Adarabo, so the Gemara says, in that scenario, they say it's just the opposite. Enum Migureshet Mid Rav Shmuel. She shouldn't be divorced because the Rabban Shmuel would say only Rishut Rabim is a location like that, but not Tzidei Rishut Rabim. My love, Hainu Rishut Rabim, Hainu Tzidei Rishut Rabim. You would think that Rishut Rabim and Tzidei Rishut Rabim are equivalent areas like we suggested originally. No, Rishut Rabim Lachud, but Tzidei Rishut Rabim Lachud. Rishut Rabim is independent of the Tzidei Rishut Rabim. Therefore, in this instance, the Simta, the Gam, and the Tzidei Rishut Rabim will be equivalent. And again, it would then be on par with the din that we find by Shabbat and other Kinyanim with regards to Tzidei Rishut Rabim. And Rishut Rabim would be the only location where the din of Rav and Shmuel applies according to this second Lashon. Although Tosafot shows that hierarchy that we just listed out is not so clear because we find stirot seemingly in the words of Rabbi Yochanan with regards to the relative standing of a Simta and the Agam. Okay, next Mishnah. A Moshiv et Ishto Chenvanit. If an individual has his wife run the store, or she is the executor of all the estate, he can ask her to take a shvua at any time to substantiate that she is acting appropriately with the money and hasn't taken any money for herself. That he's allowed to ask her to take a shvua, that she isn't withholding any of the monies for herself or taking and putting anything into her pocket. And as we know, the reason that somebody would take this money, even though they're in a perfectly good relationship, is that they justify the taking of the money since they're working so hard and since they're taking care of everything over here, they feel justified in taking it. And therefore, seemingly has the right to ask her to take a shvua as many times as he wants in order to ensure that she's acting appropriately with the money. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, afilu al pilcha valisata. He can even ask her to take a shvua for her spindle or her weaving items, as well as izata, as well as the baking that she's doing. He can ask her to take a shvua for anything that she engages in, that she's not taking anything for herself in the food that she's making for the household or that which she is weaving. Sibailu, Rabbi Eliezer, ayidigulgul kamar, olechatkhilo kamar. So Gemara asks here, when Rabbi Eliezer says he can ask her to take a shvua on these seemingly minor items, is that only de gilgul, meaning that we allow when he's already forcing her to take a shvua about something else, where you can ask her to take a shvua about these seemingly minor items? Or does he say that he can even invoke the right to ask her to take a shvua even on these items, l'chadchila? So the way that Rashi formulates the question here is that the shvua of an apitropos is only a shvua di rabbanan. Because when an apitropos, when you go and ask them to take a shvua, you don't have a Barbie claim. You don't have a definitive claim that they stole. You just ask them to take a shvua to ensure that they're acting with integrity with the estate. And therefore, you really have a Tanat Shema. But nevertheless, the Rabbanon empowered you to ask for a Shvua in those instances. And then what Rabbi Eliezer is coming to tell us is that we are Migalgalim Shvua even in Dinei Derabanan. Even though the Shvua is Midrabanan, we allow for Gilgul Shvua Midrabanan. And that's the Gemara's question. In a Shvua Doraita, we definitely allow what's called Gilgul Shvua. We allow you to then wrap in other items. If you're already taking a shvua about this, let's wrap in other items. It's sourced in the Gemara Mishnayot in Sota, in which when the Sota is already taking a shvua that she acted appropriately here, we can ask her to take a shvua about other time periods that she acted appropriately, both here, both there, and anywhere, not just in the case where she is suspected. So similarly, in a case where you have a shvua doraita, we'll allow you to extend that shvua and ask the individual to take a shvua for other items. So do over here. When she asks her to take a shvua about the store, about the estate, you can ask her to take a shvua about these items. And Rabbi Eliezer comes along and says that Gilgul shvua has application even in Dinei Derabanan, not just in Dinim Delraita, Shvua Delraita, but Shvua Derabanan also has application. And the Tanakhama says that's not the case. Or do we say the Chatkhila, that Rabbi Eliezer believes you can take the shvua independent of any Gilgul of rolling the shvua, wrapping it up with another shvua? Tosafot disagrees with Rashi's interpretation and says that we know, everybody agrees that you can be Megalgel Shvua in Shvot Dirabanan. And if you believe here that Rabbi Eliezer allows this for me a Gilgul Shvua, why would the Tanakhama disagree? So Tosafot over here, and the Tosafot read a quote from the Yerushalmi, that if we allow you to be so medakdik on the woman, then there'll never be shalom beino leveina. You can never have shalom bayit in that instance, because anybody who lives with such hakpada, nobody's going to live with that individual. And so the Tana Kama says, we're not going to allow you to be megalgal l'shua to these trivial items, because it would make the relationship untenable. And then Rabbi Lezer says, once you're already taking the shua because of the apitropos or the chenvanit, then we're going to allow you to also be megalgal l'shua onto these items. So the question is it through gilgal shua? Rashi's saying that we allow gilgal shua derabanan, or are we saying that you can take the shua independently? And according to Tosafot, do we allow the gilgal shua here, even though that would seemingly ruin the shalom bayit? Or do we say that she can force the shua even without the gilgal shua? Tashma. Amru lo Rabbi Eliezer in adam darim nachash b'kfifa. It's an expression that we've seen a number of times, that a person doesn't want to live with a snake in the same basket, because you'll never know when you're going to get bitten. If you say that Rabbi Eliezer believes that he can ask for the shua off the bat, shapir, makes sense. Ilamar tayyidik gilgul. If you say that it's only when he asks for a shua on these other items, the bigger items, do we allow him to ask on the trivial items? My nafkalamina, why does she care? If she's already taking the shua, just let her include these items. She's not stealing, so why won't she just take the shua? Damrale, because she'll say to him, came into kadaik batrai. Since you are so particular about me, you're so concerned about every penny, lomatina de durbadach. I can't live with someone that is so makbid and is so careful in this manner. And as, again, the Yerushalmi expands on that, it just does not engender, facilitate shalom bayit, and therefore an individual is not going to live under that pressure, under that scrutiny. Tashma, aresh lo patarit ishto min haneder umin hashvua, bo shiva chenvanit o shmina apotropia. So in a case where an individual does not grant his wife exemptions from taking a neder or a shvua, and he makes her into the storekeeper or the executor of the estate, harzeh mashbi'a kol zman shirtzeh, he can ask her for a shvua anytime he wants in order to ensure that she's acting with integrity. Lo ho shiva chenvanit, velo mina apotropia. If he didn't make her into a storekeeper, or he didn't appoint her as the executor of the estate, eino yachol hashbia, then he doesn't have a right to ask her for a shvua. Rabbi Elazar omer, afo pish lo shiva chenvanit, velo mina apotropia. Even if he didn't appoint her to be the storekeeper or the executor of the estate, harzeh mashbia kol zman shirtzeh, he can ask her for a shvua at any time that he wants. Because every woman, in a sense, is an executor of a certain amount of the assets of the estate. May not be over the entire estate, but over certain parts of the assets of the husband, she becomes responsible for them. And whether that's just over her spindle and her weaving, or over the isa, over the bread or the food that she's making, she's still deemed to be an apitropia, and therefore he can demand that she take a shvua. So you see here clearly that Rabbi Eliezer believes that this shvua is independent of her being a chenvanit or an apitropia. It's not a gilgul shvua. It's a shvua lechatchila that you can demand of her. Amrlo, the chachamim svetim, ein adam darim nachash b'kfifa. Person does not live in the same basket as a snake. And again, as Yerushalmi says, this does not facilitate, this does not engender the type of shalom bayit or the type of trusting relationship that we'd want to develop between a husband and a wife. As the Tosfot adds, that this is not only by Pilchai Satah, but even if she breaks Kelim in the house, if she's working in the house and normal things that happen in the house, if things break or things go wrong, he's not going to make her take a Shua every time, or we're not going to deem her to be a Shomeret Chinam or Shomeret Sachar, and she's going to have to repay all these items. Because again, it does not engender an environment or an atmosphere of love and trust between the husband and wife, and therefore we're not going to allow the husband to come down on his wife in these matters. And Shema Mina, that the Chatchila, Shema Mina, you can see here clearly that Rabbi Lezer believes that you can ask for the Shua the Chatchila, and it's not just a Gilgul Shua from a Shua about larger items or larger assets that is being rolled over to include these trivial items, but actually you can ask for the Chatchila to take a Shua over these trivial items. Okay, next Mishnah, Katav La Neder Shua in Li Alayich. If he writes that I have no right to take a neder or a shvua from you. Now, shvua means that he takes her to court and asks her to take a shvua to verify that she's been acting with integrity. Neder is a vehicle that is used in order to simulate a shvua, which is that she'll take a neder that I am asura on all the payrot in the world if such and such. So they just use the neder as a way to reinforce that she's telling the truth, and rather than using the direct method of a shvua. So if the husband says that I relinquish my right to ask you for a neder or a shvua, in yochol hashbia, then he has no right to ask her to take a shvua. Aval mashbiahu et yor sheha. he does have a right to ask those that inherit her to take a shvua, Veta Baim Bishuta, or anybody who steps into her shoes, who is acting on her behalf. Neder shvua ein li alayich val yoshayich. If he says that I have no right to ask you for a neder shvua, or your inheritors to ask them for it, val abayim bishuteich, or anyone who comes and acts as a proxy for you, eno yachol ashbia, then he can't ask her to take a shvua. Lo he, not her, lo yosheha, not her inheritors, v'lo abayim bishuta, and not anybody who acts on her behalf. Aval, but in the case yoshav, when his inheritors come and they want to force a shvua, majbimota, then they can ask her for a shvua, vet yosheha and her inheritors, vet abayim bishuta, and anybody come who's acting on her behalf. Neder shvua ainli v'lo lo yoshai, v'lo lo abayim bishuti, that neder and shvua, I don't have the right to ask for it, nobody who inherits me will have the right to ask for it, and nobody who acts on my behalf will be able to ask for it, alayich, from you, val yoshayich, or your inheritors, val bayim bishuteich, or anybody who comes on your behalf. Eino yachol, in that case, he can't be mashbia, lo hu, not him, velo yoshav, not his inheritors, velo abayim bishuto, nobody acts on his behalf, lo ata, they can't ask for that shvua, not from her, velo yoshayich, not from her inheritors, velo abayim bishuta, and not for anybody who comes and acts on her behalf. So the Gemara will discuss what the nature of the shvua that is being taken over here. Rashi says the shvua, what we're talking about here, is the shvuat ha-yorshim, a case where the yorshim come to collect her ketubah. In that case, they're required to take a shvua in order to collect the ketubah. So when he waives that right, he's waiving the right, the demand of the yorshim, that they take the shvua in such a case. Or if you think it's talking about the shvuat ha-pitropos, then in the case where he relinquishes his right to ask her for the shvua, and after she passes away, they pick up and they took over as the apitropsim for her or on her behalf. And therefore, again, he waives his right to demand a shvua of them in their role as replacing their mother as the apitropsim. And in the case of Abayim Mikocha, you have to suggest the case where she's already passed away and sold her rights to someone else, and those individuals who are coming have to take a shvua, because if she's still alive, she would have to take the shvua, and would have nothing to do with those that are coming on her behalf. Now, as far as the yorshim of the individual who can demand a shvua, we know from the Gemara in Shvuot that ein adam morish shvua, person cannot pass a shvua to his children. So what you have to say, it's a case where she passed away while the father was still alive, and therefore her yorshim have a chiyuv shvua, and then if their father passes away, then that chiyuv shvua and her yorshim will still be applicable to the yorshim of the father, because the chiyuv shvua was already in existence prior to the time that yorshim are coming to collect over here. And again, those that are acting on his behalf, we would have to explain the same way as we did by the woman, which is that if he sold some rights or whatever rights he has, then the called ba'im mikocho is those people that he empowered to act on his behalf, that he gave power of attorney to, his sale of those rights would be subject to what he had promised the woman. Again, if he sold those rights prior to the promise, then those people would have a right to it to ask for a shvua, because they were before he granted that exemption to the woman. She went after burying her husband, she goes back to her father's house, or she goes back to her father-in-law's house. She does not become the executor of the estate. Then the yorshim have no right to ask her for a shvua. On the other hand, if she does become the executor of the estate, then the yorshim have a right to ask her for a shvua from everything prospectively. But they do not have a right to ask her for a shvua on anything that came before the time that she became the executor of the estate. Now Rashi claims that this last case over here is a case where the husband granted her an exemption from the shvua. And so therefore, when he granted the exemption from the shvua, she has to take no shvua in order to collect her ketuba. And if she becomes executor of the estate, she'll also be freed from taking a shvua, at least retroactively. Prospectively, where now she becomes an executor and her taking care of the estate is on behalf of the yorshim, then the agreement that she came to with her husband has no bearing over here, because this is a new position in which she's managing the assets of the estate on behalf of the yorshim. And they have a right to ask her for a shvua. And therefore, they can demand a shvua for anything she did with the estate from the moment it became theirs. Although they can't ask her to take a shvua for anything prior to that, where the husband had already granted her an exemption for a shvua when she dealt with any of his matters. And the chiddush of the Mishnah on this point is that, even though we know already that he exempted her from a shvua, Nevertheless, the Yorshim, when they come and ask her for a Shavuah, they can't, through a Gilgul, ask the woman to take a Shavuah about that which took place while their father was alive. Because, in essence, when the father passed away and never asked her for a Shavuah until that point, it's as if he was mochel her on the Shavuah. And therefore, the Yotomim have no right to be megalgel the Shavuah on her to ask her to take a Shavuah on things that happened prior to the point in time where she became responsible to them. And based on that thesis, some of the Rishonim suggest that this part of the Mishnah is even a case where the husband did not grant her an exemption from the Shavuah, but rather it's an automatic exemption when he passes away and has not exercised his right to ask her for a Shavuah. Then he's mochel on that Shavuah, and the Yorshim are no longer allowed to ask her for a Shavuah because they're only empowered by him. And since he forgave it, they don't have a right now to come and ask for a Shavuah. Okay, we'll stop over here by the Gemara on the bottom of Pei Vav Amud Bet.